Good morning and welcome. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or set, yet belongs to each and all. In order to carry out the purposes of this lodge, there are several activities scheduled each month. Each Sunday morning throughout the month of February, from 11 until 12, a talk has been presented on the theme, Theosophy in Myths and Allegories. The talk for today is entitled, Lessons of the Zodiac. Beginning Sunday morning, March 7th, talks will be based on the theme, The Mysteries of Mind. The title of the talk for next Sunday is The Healing Power of Mind. And following all Sunday morning meetings is time for questions and discussion. On Wednesday evenings from 7:45 until 9 o'clock, a study class is being held in the Ocean of Theosophy. Last Wednesday, the class began the study of karma, that universal law of cause and effect. And next week, the chapter 11, which is the chapter on karma, will be concluded. Now, the third Friday of each month, there is a class scheduled relating to various subjects. For the last 3 months, January, February, March, the class has been studying reincarnation in myth and symbol. And this was expressed from the idea of the sun and the moon, the phoenix and the serpent. And for March 19th, the title of the talk will be Psychic and Proteus. These meetings began promptly at 7 o'clock and last for 1 hour. And the doors to the lodge are open at 6:30. On Sunday, March 21st, is a special meeting. It is called ULT Day.
We should judge March 21st.
Isn't that March 21st?
Not ULT Day.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. March 21st is William Q. Judge Day. And this is the time when students come together to commemorate the life and work of William Q. Judge. And the title of the talk for that day is William Q. Judge, Philosopher, Guide, and Friend. We are asking that all persons who plan to attend this meeting to come at least 5 minutes before the hour, be seated quietly in order to set the special tone for this occasion. Now on Saturday, April 17th, There is an Interlodge Symposium held at the National Constitution Center, which is located at 6th and Arch Streets. This meeting will be held from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. And all the details have not been worked out, but they will be forthcoming. The reference library is open each Wednesday from 5:30 until 7:30, and it carries a straight line of theosophical literature consisting of books, pamphlets, and magazines, and other periodicals. There are also other textbooks located in this library which may be of interest. During library hours, assistance is always available in answering questions of a theosophical nature, as well as helping to locate references. There is also a reference available on each Wednesday in connection with the class meeting. Just outside of the library, you will find on display the same straight theosophical literature. It is for sale, and it may be purchased either during the library hours or before or after our regular meetings. All activities of this lodge are free. The lodge continues to be sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are most welcome to participate. The reading for today has been selected from Judge's articles, and the title is The Two Lost Keys. The Bhagavad Gita and the Zodiac, while differing so much from each other, in that one is a book and the other the sun's path in the heavens, are two great storehouses of knowledge which may be construed after the same method. It is very true that the former is now in book shape, but that is only because the necessities of study under conditions which have prevailed for some thousands of years require it. But it exists in the ideal world embedded in the evolutionary history of the human race. Were all copies of it destroyed tomorrow, the materials for their reconstruction are near at hand, and could be regathered by those sages who know the realities underlying all appearances. And in the same way, the zodiac could be made over again by the same sages, not, however, by our modern astronomers. The latter, no doubt, would be able to construct a path of the sun with certain classifications of stars thereon, but it would not be the zodiac. It would bear but little relation to the great cosmic and microcosmic periods, not even which that path really has. They would not apply it to as it is found used in old and new almanacs, but its individual human being, for they do not know what it can in any way be so connected. With their system of hardly admit any actual sympathy between man and the zodiac, not yet having come to know that man is himself a zodiacal highway through which his own particular sun makes a circuit. The subject of the talk for the day is Lessons of the Zodiac.
Friends, it occurs that many people hearing this title, Lessons of the Zodiac, might think that this would be a presentation on astrological signs and how we could use them to interpret our lives or get advice on how we should conduct our lives, what might happen to us this coming week,
and our relationships, the kind of things we read about in the newspapers or magazines or online that have to do with astrological forecasts. But we must admit that all those matters relate to the personality and its affairs in life. The kinds of lessons that we're speaking about of the zodiac, and actually the kinds of lessons we want to gather from a theosophical study in general, are those that add to the richness of our soul life, that give us insight into who we are, why we are here, where we are going, and how we are going to get there. Our place in the universe, our interconnectedness with all of life. We're talking about lessons regarding soul wisdom and not just wisdom relating to the personal affairs of our lives, although that may be quite interesting for some people. So the first thing we want to start out with is an understanding that the zodiac is much more than an astronomical record of the sun's apparent cyclical path in relation to different constellations of stars. This is just one aspect, its astronomical significance. And if we think of the zodiac as a symbol, which we are invited to in this particular series of talks, we need to understand that every symbol has layers of meaning, seven layers of meaning, the astronomical and physical being only one, and perhaps the most superficial. It is actually, though, as suggested by the reading, in its deeper sense, a storehouse of knowledge, of wisdom that has many lessons for us, because the zodiac as a system of understanding life was actually constructed for the generations of that time, as well as for future generations, by sages, wise human beings who understood the relationship of the zodiac to the great cycles and events in the life of the universe, of our planet, and of the nations, races, and individuals of this earth, and the life of the ordinary human being. What did these sages understand, and what was their basic teaching? Well, they first of all understood the underlying unity of life. They understood the interconnectedness and sympathy that exists in all departments of nature. This was concisely stated in the Hermetic idea, as above, so below. A constant reminder that within ourselves, we are copies of the universe, of the cosmos. If we look but within and understand ourselves, we can understand the nature around us, and vice versa. The more we understand of nature, the more we can see and reflect and understand its processes going on in ourselves. And the Greeks immortalized this in the statement above, the Delphic Oracle, man, know thyself. So the zodiac then signifies the path and signposts of the sun as it goes through its cosmical annual journey throughout the sky every year. But its symbols of the zodiac also refer to man's individual zodiac, or what we may say it would be an evolutionary cyclical journey for the human being. And if we think of ourselves as not only physical or spiritual beings, that we have a whole inner mental and moral and psychic life, this journey is one of intellectual, spiritual, and physical evolution. And all this is symbolized in that zodiac. So it is much more than just a physical representation of the heavenly cycles or of the influences they may have on just the physical affairs of our life. So as we can see, all the chief fundamental theosophical principles, that of there being an underlying unity of life, the universality of cyclical law and cause and effect, and evolution. All of these fundamental theosophical principles or lessons from the past are presented under symbolism in the zodiac. So the next thing we'd like to consider, what is the zodiac? What is its origin from a theosophical perspective? The zodiac, we might be interested in realizing, is a Greek word, actually, and it means a circle of animals. Now, granted, not all the symbols there are animals. Most of them are, 10 of them are, and there are a few hybrid human forms, but this term was thought suitable because most of the symbols are of the animal nature. And it is understood that this circle of animals and the various mythological characters are allegorical representations of the ring of constellations that line the ecliptic of the sun's apparent course through the sky every year. And these same symbols that we see, for example, in the Roman or the Latin system, which we're most familiar with, are also used in zodiacs around the world, Eastern and Western. We'll just give a few examples. For example, Taurus, which is the Latin word for bull, the identical month or season is referred to in the Sanskrit as Vrishabha, which means the steer or the bull of heaven. And Leo, of course, the lion in the Latin, has its corresponding term and designation of the month for lion as Simcha or Simha. And of course, Cancer, the crab in the Latin system, has its corresponding month titled Karka or the crayfish in Sanskrit. So it's curious to see this common use of terms and figures throughout the world by cultures that have no other connections, and it forces us to ask some questions. Why is that there? Is there a common understanding or insight or a common influence? But whatever that answer might be, it is clear that these 12 symbols divide the cyclical path of the sun across this ecliptic into 12 equal portions, or the distance or the longitude that the sun would travel every 30 days as it moves its way around this imaginary cycle in the heavens. So when we say that Leo, the constellation, and Leo, the sign, we're talking about two different things. Leo, the constellation, may be very big in terms to another constellation, but Leo, the astrological sign, refers to an equal portion of the zodiac as any other portion. So the Romans, we mentioned the Roman terms of Taurus, Leo, and Cancer that we're most familiar with, inherited their system from the Greeks. And the Greeks, it is understood now, that they inherited their ideas from the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans, of course, received their knowledge from the Hindus, the Brahmanical Hindus. But we always like to ask questions, and so we ask, well, who did the Brahmins get it from? Who did they get it from? And Theosophy refers to the records of two grand figures from the distant past, the archaic past. It's interesting that the construction of the zodiac described by Ptolemy in the 2nd century AD, was described much, much earlier in the Rig Veda. And for those who are familiar with the Hindu Vedas, you know that each of the Vedas, the Rig Veda included, is contributed or attributed to the teachings of a great seer or sage. They call them rishis. And one of these great seers or rishis, his name was Narada. And Narada calculated and recorded all the astronomical cycles, not only those that had been known in the past, but of those to come. And he is the one who, in the Vedas, is attributed to having taught this, a science directly to the first astronomers, instructed them in the art of observing the sun and the cycles that would recur. One of his works that is recorded, The Mirror of Futurity, recalls all these different cycles within cycles. And they mention another figure, Asura Maya, who is described, interestingly, as an Atlantean. So his records would seem to go back even further into the past. He based his astronomical works on records of past geological and cosmical periods, and his records not only refer to the various cycles of prehistoric events such as the evolution and transformation of races in the past, they also refer to cycles that will come in the future of this life cycle, or the end of what we call the seventh human race, millions of years in the future. So all this is worked out in these books, and the work of these two ancient sages furnishes us with the figures of our cycles and the possibility of calculating the dates of cycles to come. So one concept we want to get is that over many, many thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, we will see that these sages carefully recorded to a mathematical preciseness the recurrence of certain heavenly phenomena again and again and again, and compared them and recorded them in context of various cycles in the affairs of human nature, human conditions, whether nations, races, and civilizations. So we have simultaneously evolving a record of recurring events, of cycles in human nature, and a record of recurring phenomena in the heavens. Now, just how long does this go back? Well, the Dendera zodiac in Egypt records three and a half sidereal cycles, which is 87,000 years worth of records of astronomical events. The Hindu calculations cover 33 sidereal cycles. Now, if you do the math, that's 850,000 years. How far does that go back? Well, according to theosophical sources, 850,000 years ago would be the time of the destruction by flood, primarily, of the largest continents of Atlantis. So basically, these ancient Aryan, Hindu, Atlantean recordings have been going on since the very beginning of our current fifth race and the destruction of Atlantis. Almost a million years, 850,000 years. And it is these ancient records which are the basis from which the Hindus got their cycles. But we don't stop asking questions there. We say, well, where did the where did the Atlantean sages get their records from? And so we go even further back, and we see in the traditions of cultures and all around the world, and their scriptures and their legends, and of course in the teachings of theosophy, we see that before even the Atlantean, or what we call the fourth root race, there was an earlier civilization of humanity, self-conscious human beings. We might call them the Lemurian, or the third root race. And this is where humanity first reached its state of self-consciousness. And at this point, they were instructed in all the arts and sciences by wise human beings. And their instructors taught them, among other things, the zodiac and its meaning. So we ask, well, where did they get it? Well, they said, well, they were individuals who had perfected their knowledge in former periods of evolution. So we see that what we understand of the zodiac, or is the accumulated record and teaching that goes back into the very beginnings of human understanding on this planet. And as a system of thought and understanding, the universe must have been in existence even before this earth came into being, because we must acknowledge that this is a universe of law and cycles, and these processes were going on somewhere even before our world came into existence. So we're talking about here an substantial record. So we might say that the history of the world is recorded in the zodiac. Now, how might that be? Well, we've all used our watch or a clock to remind us when to do certain things. But we know that we don't need a clock or a watch to remind us when we're hungry, because we've conditioned ourselves to eat at certain times, or when we are tired. The human organism has a certain cycle in itself, and at a certain time we understand that we're going to need sleep. And so we look at our clock and we say, well, it's 4:30 now. I know I'm about 6 o'clock I'm going to get hungry, and about 10:30 I'm going to get tired. Now, that's not a prophecy. That's not some type of psychic prediction. That's experience. That's knowledge. We've gone through this cycle over and over and over again, and we know from 10, 20, 30 years of experience that when that clock comes around, this is what's going to happen. There's knowledge. So if these things have been observed for 850,000 years, think how much more knowledge we have. All these cycles, there's nothing new under the sun, just variations of the same theme, and it corresponds with certain cycles in the clock of the heavens, that those that have this knowledge can say that at a certain time or a certain year or a certain age, certain affairs are going to repeat themselves in general, are going to come back again under cyclic law or karmic law, and are going to affect nations, races, individuals, spiritually, morally, mentally, psychically, physically, because these are all the different kinds of cycles. That what we call historical, national, or racial cycles are really made up of the individual cycles of the people that make up that particular nation and race. And all cycles of individuals relate to their karmic operational fields, that of their physical life, their mental life, their moral life, and their emotional life. So the zodiac and its mystical relations to the affairs of nations and individuals are at the bottom of all the mythological stories we have, as these mythological stories, whether we have them from the Bhagavad Gita or the Mahabharata or the legends of Troy and the Iliad and the Odyssey in the Western traditions, are all symbolic of the relationship, the interconnectedness between humanity and the cosmos. And all these figures are symbolic of certain processes going on in human nature, as well as certain laws and operations going on in great nature. And it is said that the Eastern initiates or adepts or wise human beings who have preserved these teachings say that they've been preserving records of the racial events and events of the universal events since the beginning of the fourth race, the beginning of the Atlantean race. And the return of cyclical events is based on the same mathematical precision as the astronomer's record of the periodical behavior or meteors, comets, and certain stars. Now, we know of Halley's Comet. That's a popular one. Comes back every, 70 years or something like that. And so when an astronomer says that we're going to have a certain astronomical event, whether it's a Pleiades meteorite shower is going to occur at a certain time, it's based with mathematical precision and understanding. And in the same way, the affairs of the soul, of these cyclical events, can also be determined with the same mathematical precision and accuracy. So this is knowledge, as we said. It's not something mysterious, although we may not have that knowledge. But if we did, it would just be as logical and understandable to us as any other way we use cycles. So we come to perhaps one of the most interesting questions of this subject. Is there an influence or a connection to individuals. Now, we know the popular idea is that the zodiac has a direct influence on our lives. So we need to understand what that means from a theosophical perspective. So we ask, is there that influence? Now, we started out this talk with an understanding that man himself is a copy of the universe. That means that just as there is a zodiac in the heavens, you might say, there man himself is a zodiac. So if the sun is moving through the various constellations and that constitutes the physical zodiac that we understand, what is the sun in man's zodiac? Well, the sun there stands for the immortal ego, the spiritual being, whose movement or progression through the long cycle of incarnation through various stages of enlightenment, of initiation, is symbolized by this zodiac. We might also say that the various principles, capacities, tendencies, whether they be spiritual, moral, psychical, mental, physical, are also represented in these symbols. So it refers to our movement as immortal beings through various personal conditions of varying degrees. That is our zodiacal path. And there is a correspondence, a relationship between our principles as human beings and the various cycles of events that goes on among humanity, among this earth, and in the cosmos. There is that interrelationship because we are all part of one reality we call the theific principle. Now, we know that people speak in the terms of astrology or a zodiacal influence as a certain star they're born under, like what is your astrological sign or star or constellation. But Theosophy makes a very interesting point. It's, although there is a astrological sign or star assigned to the time of when we're born, that only relates to the personality of this life. In other words, it is symbolic of all the causes and effects that are coming back to affect that individual at the time of its birth, mental, physical, moral, emotional. The karmic inheritance of all its past actions is symbolized in that star. And one who understands the symbolism can see the influences on that individual. It is not destiny or fated that they have to act in a certain way, because our karmic conditions of our lives are only partly influenced by what we inherit from the past. A good deal of it is the result of what we are doing now, the choices we make now that will mitigate or change the direction of that karma. The other star is more mysterious. It is the star that represents the character of our immortal ego. As we said, that ego, that sun, is traveling in its own cycle of evolutionary development over many lives. And it develops a certain character or inner essence that predominates in its nature. And that symbol, or that is the spiritual essence or character that at ego has evolved over time, that places it in a different state, we might say, of influence or intelligence than another. So we know that as we go through a schoolroom, we are all, as students, getting the same lessons, but we don't all bring to it the same knowledge and experience. Even if we've been in the same grade before, we each vary in the ability to which we understand and can apply, and how we apply that knowledge. And so that distinguishes us as students, even though the classroom that we are going through may differ. So we need to understand that from a theosophical perspective, the zodiacal understanding of our lives, or the astrological understanding, is much more not just our personal lives, but where we've come and how we've evolved as egos, as souls, in this long journey of life. So we say, does the zodiac, or does astrology, is it fate? Does it determine our destiny? You know, only brings to us, under karmic law, the results of our previous actions, and maybe also the particular impediments that we will have to face in life, that may be obstacles. Some of those we may be able to overcome by our free will and choice. But like a rock that holds back the ocean for a time being, if those previous causes have set up so many impediments from the past that no matter what we may do in this life, we can't seem to overcome it. On the other hand, no matter what we may acquire in this life, if we do many other things, if we've done many other things in the past, they may come through as tremendous opening opportunities for us. We may run into people or circumstances that lift us out of conditions that we ourselves don't seem to be able to deal with. So all these things fall under this whole subject. But the main idea is that the stars themselves don't directly influence us. They are like messengers, they are like timekeepers, mirrors to ourselves of the actions we've made in the past and the influences that will come back to us in various cycles, in various times, under various conditions. So we'd like to stop here. We're sure that there are many questions that you have and comments, and we'll do our best to address them from the theosophical point of view. Yes.
So if in working through our karmic lessons, we so change our circumstances, that would it be possible then to be under the influence or somehow connected with another sign in the zodiac? In other words, as we go through and change our life circumstances, does that change any influence or connection?
Mm-hmm. Remember that we have two astrological signs. One that is our inheritance from the past, but the other represents our accumulated wisdom and experience through many, many lives. So if one represents the tip of the iceberg, which is the conditions we find ourselves in this life symbolized by that astronomical symbol, we say, the overwhelming 99, 95% of our experience or influence is under the surface. So our challenge is to learn how to get that tip of the iceberg out of the way, so all that other experience and character can come through. So it's not so much that we become under the influence of another star, another constellation, but that we become more and more under the influence of our immortal ego and its accumulated knowledge and wisdom. There was a report. Yes.
We recall reading the statement that the sign or the zodiac that we're born under does not compel us to do anything, but it does impel us. Does that suggest that if we come to understand it better, that we can use it, kind of like working with the cycles thing, the more we understand something, the more we can benefit from its use, proper use?
Okay. So the question is that the cycles do not necessarily compel us, but they can impel us. Does that mean we can use it? Well, we all could make our own zodiacs. There's nothing, difficult about it. Just make a biorhythm chart out your moods, for example. And let's say you want to chart out your happy mood, and you're going to give it the symbol of a fish, because you like fish. And so a fish represents when your happy mood is at its peak. And you're going to chart out the moods of your miserable, combative self, and you're going to symbolize that as a bull, because a bull reminds you of that. All right, so you have two symbols. And you've been keeping records, and you know every 3 months your interirritable cycle is at its peak, and that's the ascending of your bull. Okay, and then you know at other times, every 6 months, maybe your happy cycle is at peak, and that's the fish. Now, there are going to be some times when you know that, hey, that bull cycle is coming again, or that fish cycle is coming. Well, it's good to know that. If you're trying to start some project, you don't want to start it when you're going to, when you know you're going to be really irritable. You might wait till you're in a better mood if it has to do with a relationship or dealing with people. It's also good to know that a miserable cycle might be coming, but so is a happy cycle. The fish and the bull are sort of like in conjunction, like they say, and so one's going to set off the other. That although it might be a bad cycle, it won't be so bad. So maybe you could do something. So there, it's very simplified. Of course, if we have knowledge of our cycles and develop little system to represent it to ourselves, that's basically what the ancient sages have done through hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years and to develop this complex system. So yes, of course, the more knowledge we have of ourselves, because we are karma, we are the representation of cycles, the more we can use it to help ourselves and others. Yes?
Most ancient civilizations spend a great deal of time looking at the heavens and charting the stars and their position. We would imagine because they were more tied to nature and the cycles of nature. What's happening to our civilization now? We seem to have lost touch with that nature aspect of our own nature, let alone the zodiac. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is clear that if you go around the world, that the observation of the sun and the stars was central to a particular people or culture or civilization. We look around our civilization and we see that our great resources financially, intellectually, creatively go into the construction of scientific, technological achievements, of buildings, of various things. But the ancients, they applied all their knowledge and wealth and human resources into the construction of permanent buildings and devices that would help them understand the cycles of the sun, because they knew it told them things that were very important about themselves, not just when the rains would come or when it would be time to plant, but also that there was an intimate connection between themselves and nature, that nature was a mirror of what was going to happen to them. Now, we've lost that sense. All one has to do is spend a weekend in the woods or in the mountains to understand how much one has lost, how much one is out of touch with nature by living in the city. And so that accumulated effect over generations, we have lost that sensitivity. But there are many Native American peoples that live in more rural areas who depend on these cycles. We know we have the Farmer's Almanac and various almanacs, and are very much in tune with the cycles of nature and its effect on their lives. Yes?
We know that the zodiac represents the four faces of man, which is the lion, the cow, and the eagle. Now, these also branch off as meaning something. We look at the cow's horn, which basically means energy. They have related it to Toyota, which Toyota's emblem is represents the horns. When we look at the eagle, now it's hard to perceive that an eagle can turn to a scavenger. They've also basically discussed this. I think it went to a scorpion or something. But anyhow, you have done a wonderful job with this. You could go on every Sunday with this because there's so much added to this and it branches off. Did a terrific job.
Well, we hear what you're saying, but if you take the basic symbols, and let's just say that we have 12 houses and all the different combinations of conjunctions that can occur between those houses, the possible influences on that could occur are, well, they're astronomical. I mean, there's so many different possible combinations. Of course we could, but to what purpose? the amount of possible combinations is so overwhelming that we couldn't use it in our everyday lives. And not only that, the sun, here's the thing, the sun is not stationary. It's moving in its own great cycle. So its relationship to the constellations now is different than it will be 100,000 or 200,000 years from now, because it's moved to a different spot. It's moving around its own great cycle around our Milky Way galaxy. So all the astronomical calculations and correspondences and meanings that we have now will be useless to us 200,000 years in the future, unless we understand the more universal or hidden aspects. So when we say that the Chinese have a very good astronomical system, or the Mayans have a very good astronomical system, it's true. But it was derived at a time when the astronomical correspondence was and relationships were different than they are now. So they may not have any relevance to us now. They may have been very relevant to the people at that time, but are not now. So we can get lost in that quagmire, that forest of influences. It's perhaps much more productive to us to hold on to the basic lessons by which we can conduct our lives than try to get lost in the details of our personalities. Yes, in the back.
Driving in this morning, I was listening to NPR, and there was an interview with an athlete, and a coach was quoted. And the quote was that luck is the residue of design. So when we're trying to design our daily lives, are we better suited to design from the viewpoint of the sun or of these houses of the zodiac?
Are we, if we're trying to design our lives in order to make it more fortunate, because we say luck is the byproduct or the residue of our design. People who are lucky are not lucky without a lot of effort and sweat put into it. Things work out for them. It may not, but without that effort and sweat, it's not going to happen at some point. So how are we better able to, what is the best way for us to conduct our lives based on the sun or the houses, the 12 houses or constellations? Let's remember what they're symbolic of that has immediate reference to us. The sun is symbolic of our immortal spiritual nature. The houses represent the personal conditions we go through in a certain cycle. And we can trace the cycle of our personality through various stages. And we know that our personalities have changed. We're not the same personality that we were as a child, or that we were as a teenager, or we were as a young adult, or as we were as a householder, or as an elderly person, retired. The personality changed, but our inner character, our egoic identity, has remained the same. So where is it best for us to build our house on? Do we build it on what shifts? Shifting sands, or are we to build it on what's rock solid and permanent? Where do we have the most likelihood of being successful, fortunate in life? And the more we know of that which is permanent and enduring in ourselves, the better we can make choices to make the better choices we can make on that firm foundation as opposed to what shifts. Because as we said before, the shifting part of life is relative. What is true today may not be true in the future, and certainly was not true in the past. So you can use that relative knowledge in a certain context, but you can't constantly rely. It doesn't rely for everybody in the world at the same time. Okay, so we have to keep that in mind. Yes?
In one of HPV's articles, I'm not sure which one it is, she talks about years that end in certain numbers, like number 9, etc. I'm not sure if it's been years or whatever it is. We're in the year 2010. We've heard about 2012. We've heard about the Mayans talking about us being in the center of the Milky Way around 2012. Anywhere in the teachings, is there any references to what may be going on cyclically around this time for humanity?
Is there any reference to what is going on cyclically at this time for humanity? And we need to understand that humanity as a whole, as a race of human beings, goes through various cycles, just as human beings do, that there are influences that have been set up from past actions of ourselves as a humanity. We all think and feel approximately in the same way, and that creates a certain tendency that repeats itself. So at one of those cycles of humanity as a race in the Sanskrit is called the Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age, or the Iron Age. It is a period of time that is said to last 432,000 years by the Hindu calculations, which, as we've seen, have gone go back to the Asura Mayan calculations, which were over 850,000 years. So certainly they had understanding of these longer periods of cycles. This Kali Yuga, which is said to last 432,000 years, the first part of it, the first 5,000 years of it, came to an end in 1897, which corresponds also to the zodiacal movement from the sign of Pisces into the age of Aquarius. 1897. But changes don't happen just like that. You don't go from 1896 and all of a sudden you're in a new cycle of 1897. There's a dawn and there's a twilight to every cycle, and these can be hundreds of years. So we, in a sense, at this time, we might say, are in the dawning of a new age. And so even though 1897 marks the beginning, there are critical dawning periods. And HPB has said that if certain changes are not taken up, certain things are not accomplished, not only by theosophists, but humanity at large, 100 years hence, like the beginning of the 21st century, it could be a heaven on earth, or it could sink into horrors not ever seen before on this planet. So there is understanding that we are at a critical time in the choices we make as a humanity. Yes?
Reference was made earlier to 2012, and just an interesting observation. It's our understanding that that Mayan calendar, which ended in 2012, started 3000 BC. So that's the same 5,000-year cycle as we find in from Krishna, and we also find in the Mahabharata. Isn't there symbolically that Arjuna got his wife from
Patala refers to the Antipodes.
South America, mm-hmm. Right, the Antipodes. And so there was
a lot of connection there. So, yes, we know with the popular interest in 2012 from the Mayan calendar, it ends at that time, or the long count ends at that time, and some take that as an interpretation of being there being vast destruction. And we can understand why, because it is an ancient tradition that at the end of every great cycle there is a cataclysmic event that occurs. But the knowledge of those great cycles is not generally given out for obvious reasons. But whenever there is a beginning and end of a great, great cycle, there is a cataclysmic event in the affairs of humanity. And it is interesting that when we had that 5,000-year cycle reached in 1897, there was a cataclysm of effects on this planet. We had not only in the affairs of man and tremendous political changes, scientific upheavals, social upheavals, but even the earth itself, in terms of volcanoes, eruptions, tidal waves, went through tremendous changes at that time, which have not been seen since until very recently. So, yes, there are some changes, but those Mayan understandings, you know, there's Mayan teachings which are exoteric, and there's Mayan teachings which are esoteric, which are in the hands of their, we might say, their adepts or their keepers of the time, and what they teach is different. And what they say is that represents not so much a destruction of our physical nature, our physical planet, but a destruction in the same sense of a transformation from one state of consciousness into another. That represents the death of one way of thinking into a higher, more universal way of thinking. And so we come into a new time, a new influence, and therefore a new set of conditions. Once again, the Mayans understood the same ancient principle. The calendar that applies to one period does not necessarily apply to a new age. So naturally it comes to an end because new conditions, new relations are formed among humanity. So there's nothing destructive in there. It's just an understanding of the different cycles and how they apply at different times.
In this, what we've been talking about, what you've been talking about, doesn't really, it's not essentially pure prophecy as we encounter it, we'll say, in the Book of Revelations or anything like that. But I do pick up, I don't know, I don't come this often, so there are other things that happen, feed into this, that I'm not getting here. But when we talk about this, we're preoccupied to an extent with what's going to happen. And the only downside I see to this is that if you do take up your thinking about this day after day, so I'm not saying these people are, but you're not actually where you are right now. And this is...
So the contribution is, if you're too much concerned about the future or what's going to happen to you in the future, you're not really dealing with the present issues and concerns. And other people might argue, well, that might be true, but the information we can get from those sources may help me better make decisions about what I need to do today. If I understand my past and what might happen in the future, that may influence me now. Actually, when you think about it, what we understand as time is illusionary and is relative. From the spiritual point of view, all there really is now. Awareness of now. Past, present, and future have no real existence for us. The future is only the effect of what we are doing now, and what we are doing now is only the effect of what we've done in the past. And we've just talked for a few seconds, but it's still the same now. And that past no longer exists, and in 10 seconds we'll have another future. It doesn't exist yet, but there still will be this now. That's the eternal part. That's what we have to concentrate on, keep our mind on, the eternal present, to live and dwell and act from that basis, because the causes we set up now will be the conditions we face in the future, regardless of what the stars show. They are only the mirrors, the servants, we might say, of our actions. One more question.
And that makes perfect sense with the 2012 conversation, because Shiva, the destroyer, also represents the regeneration into something else. And what was just said, while we're reaping the effects, our reactions are the new causes. So we're constantly remaking, recreating something, hopefully better for the future period in that eternal now, which is what that 2012 represents, the regeneration into something else.
We'd like to finish our meeting with a contribution that was handed to me earlier by a student. And it has to do with the zodiac as understood by the Hebrew tradition. And it's interesting that in the astrological system of the Hebrews, the word mazel does not really mean luck. It is associated with the 12 signs of the zodiac, each of which are called mazelot. And the teaching is that from the divine source, energy flows through this entire system and eventually reaches us. And this energy passes through these signs, the stars and planets, and reaches all of creation. So everything is interconnected with this energy, that flows from the divine source through these various mazalot. And the Talmud gives three life issues which are affected by the mazalot: life, childhood, and livelihood. But it also goes on to say that a person must pray with sincere supplication that these influences can be overcome by prayer, meaning meditation, and with right deeds, with right actions. And so when one uses the expression mazel tov, in that, it means that this energy that is coming down from our higher nature, this divine source, should come into our lives, should illuminate us, and give us sustenance and wisdom. So it is like a prayer. And literally it means, may this drip of inspiration from your soul above not dissipate, but rather have a positive and lasting effect, that from this event onwards you should live your life with higher consciousness. You should be aware of the blessings in your life and be ready to receive more and more. So we thought that's an interesting way to conclude our idea from a little bit different perspective. Our meeting's adjourned.
Excellent.
Well, thanks for coming.